So to get started, first thing is I'm from Arizona, and this is Phoenix. And the thing I always ask people when I want to talk about Phoenix, and that is, how many rivers do you see in that picture? There are three major rivers in that picture. There's a river right here. This is the Salt River. This is the Gila River. And right here is the Agua Fria. The thing about this river right here is, the rivers you notice is there's no water. However, in about 1993, this river right here had about 300,000 cubic feet per second going down it. Every once in a while, we'll get just the right conditions that the rivers flow. But the thing about this river here, when that happened, bridges went out. So we do have rivers, but like I say, there's no water. You'll see a little bit of water right here. That's a man-made lake in Tempe. ASU is right there. When you land at the airport, you'll go over that once in a while, and you'll see the water. So there's no water in the river, and then there's a little bit of water, and then there's no water in the river. So because of that, we have water scarcity in Arizona. This is just a map of precipitation and temperature. We live in the wettest desert in the world. And a desert is defined simply by evapotranspiration exceeds precipitation. And because it's very hot, we get about 10 inches of rain a year. That's not very much, but we have an ET demand of probably about a meter and a half. So part of what Arizona had to do to deal with its water issues, our groundwater was just depleting really rapidly. And everything was, all the farming, everything was based on groundwater. In the early 1900s, about 1903, Salt River Project comes in, they built some dams, and started to deliver surface water. However, in the 1960s, Arizona realized that they weren't taking their full allotment of the Colorado River water, so they wanted to find ways that they could appropriate some of that water and get some of that water into central Arizona. The Bureau of Reclamation was unwilling to provide that water until they came up with a plan to deal with their groundwater. So in 1980, the Groundwater Management Act came about. And the Groundwater Management Act, what it did is it divided the state up into these basins. So you'll see here, anything that's in yellow is an active management area where they manage groundwater. In essence, by 2030, they had to have a plan in place to where groundwater withdrawals did not exceed groundwater replenishment. That hasn't happened yet. It probably won't happen by 2030. But because they put these into place, they were able to then start to get Colorado River water. The next part of this is that in 1996, they came up with this idea of, they passed a law, and we have the Arizona Water Banking Authority. And what that is we can simply take, if we have extra Colorado River water, if we have extra SRP water, or if we have wastewater, we can replenish the groundwater with that. So we put on spreading basins and we let the groundwater replenish. Every bit of water you put in, you can now have claim to take back out. With fresh water, well, I put fresh water in quotes because the Colorado River water or SRP water, any water that comes from that hasn't been used once, it may have high salinity, it may have other problems with it, but you get a one-to-one credit for what you recharge. If you use wastewater, you'll get about 70% of your credit. So if you recharge an acre foot, you get 7/10 of an acre foot you can withdraw later. So that brings up wastewater treatment plants. So one of the other things about Arizona, if you remember back to that picture, all the places where we could put water now have houses. So in essence, when you have a wastewater treatment plant, there are only three wastewater treatment plants in all of Phoenix that have access to a river that can put water back into the river. Every other sewer treatment plant has to find someplace else to put its water, whether it's irrigation, groundwater recharge. So that's sort of the paradigm we work with in Arizona. So the town of Gilbert, about 220,000 people, 47 square miles. You can see the outline of the town here. It has two wastewater treatment plants, one in the north and one in the south, and they have no place to discharge the water. So everything that comes out has to be dealt with either for irrigation or recharge. So I was working with a Neely plant. It treats the waste from 130,000 people approximately, 11 million gallons a day of flow, and its peak flow is about 27.5 million gallons a day. The retention time in the plant is about 30 hours. So when the plant is located, let's see, about here, and the place where it disposes of most of its water is here is where it can do groundwater recharge. The rest is the rest of the water is used for parks, irrigation, that sort of thing. This is the riparian preserve where they do the recharge. So you'll notice here we have a number of basins. The basins are managed such that when you bring a basin online, so here's a basin right here that's being recharged. Here's a basin that's undergoing like rehabilitation. What they do is they'll fill a basin to a foot deep. They let it infiltrate. Then they fill it again to a foot deep. They let it infiltrate. They fill it again. And they have sort of the operators of each of the preserve have an idea of each basin, approximately how fast infiltration needs to occur for the basin to still be working properly. As soon as it drops below that level, they let the basin dry completely. They'll go back and they'll disc it to try and increase infiltration again. Infiltration is limited because you end up getting algae and sediments building up on the surface, filling the pores and preventing infiltration. So here's some pictures of the preserve. It's about 67.2 acres of recharge area. They're permitted for 8 million gallons a day of infiltration. When they started the project, depth to groundwater was about 168 feet. Now depth to groundwater is about 148 feet. So they're actually bringing the groundwater level up. It's sort of generalized to that area, but still they're adding to the groundwater. The other thing about this is they made a conscious effort when they built the plant or when they built the recharge facility to make it a place where people wanted to go. It's a place where birders come all winter long to see birds or they're part of the Pacific Flyway. And the one thing about that is by the city doing that, if DEQ came and said we want to close this project down, people wouldn't let them. Because every day of the year it gets used, people walk around it. The community really enjoys it. So this is the average volume of recharge. This is a 10-year average that's been smoothed. So you can in essence see that starting in October, and going to October, we have this sort of annual change in what happens to recharge volumes. We max out in the wintertime. Our minimum is in the summertime. And the reason for that is that there's a certain amount of water coming out of the plant. In the winter, there's not a lot of evaporative demand. The city doesn't overseed parks, so the amount of irrigation water goes down dramatically. Use. So they have to find a place for this to go. So they put it in recharge basins. The thing about this is, this also means we have difference in temperature between when recharge is happening and when recharge isn't happening. This is soil temperature at 10 centimeters and 50 centimeters. You see that in the summertime, we'll end up with temperatures between 35 and 40 degrees centigrade. In the wintertime, it drops down to about 10 degrees centigrade. So there's a huge fluctuation in the temperature that the soil that this water is exposed to as it's infiltrating. Another thing, carbamazepine, we have the compound I'm going to be working with. This is actual data from the outflow from the plant, and it shows that we also have seasonal differences in the concentration of the compound coming out of the plant. And what it shows here is the thing about this is the January for most compounds, the winter is higher concentration. And the reason the winter is higher concentration is because our population almost doubles every winter because all the snowbirds come in. The snowbirds also bring a lot more medical needs. And so our concentrations are higher in the wintertime, lower for the most part in the summertime. So I wanted to look at the effect of temperature on the transport. So we took a Casa Grande sandy loam, which is the same soil that's at the riparian preserve. The only problem was if we took it from the riparian preserve, we would have a lot of background concentration there. So we went and found some places that had never had wastewater effluent irrigation. Took some soil samples. We analyzed them for carbamazepine. No carbamazepine. We did 4 repeated sorption events. So we would add the compound. We'd take some of it away, add it again. So we used 20 mils of water. I think I have a slide about that. Then we did desorption events too. So after the first adsorption event, we did a desorption event. After the second adsorption event, we did a desorption event, and so forth. I mean, it's 3 temperatures. This is the soil characteristics. We had pH 7.3, about neutral. EC 2.5 decisiemens per meter. It's very sandy, which is good for recharge. And what's interesting about the recharge is we find that about 90% of the recharge occurs over about 15% of the total surface area. Because you'll have these lenses, these areas where you have sandy soils and then more clay soils. And most of the infiltration happens in those areas where there's sandy soil versus the other place. So most of this water is flowing pretty rapidly through some fairly small area. So we used 5 carbamazepine levels for sorption, 0, 0.5, 1, 5, and 10 part per billion. That's about the concentrations we had in the effluent are at the low end of that. We used 5 grams of soil, put 20 mils of carbamazepine solution in. We equilibrated for 24 hours. We found that was enough time for equilibration. We used 10, 26, and 40 degrees C. And then after the equilibration, we removed 10 milliliters for analysis. We would then add back another 10 mils of carbamazepine-containing solution of the same concentration. Because when you're doing recharge, in essence, it's continually being exposed to the same concentration. For the desorption events, we had some duplicate tubes that we then would take out. We would remove all the solution, and we'd add carbamazepine-free water and let it desort. Here's the adsorption events. It shows that there's definitely a temperature effect on sorption. At 10 degrees C, we have much higher adsorption than at 40. If you look also at, using the Freundlich equation, if you look at the linearity of the sorption, the linearity is around 1, so it's doing well, and in essence, the more times we adsorb it, the closer the linearity gets to 1, the closer the end gets to 1. This is looking at the desorption and sorption, and what this is, the more there's variation between the dotted line and the solid line, means you have hysteresis. And what that shows is that we have a lot more hysteresis at low temperatures than we do at high temperatures. We also see that over time, with repeated application, we're sort of coming down to an eventual equilibrium where our distribution coefficient between solid and aqueous phase, after 4 repeated events, this is sort of what is being exposed to in the soil. So we found that KF was positively related to temperature. At higher temperature, we had lower KFs, and at higher temperature, we had higher KFs. Hysteresis was greatest at low temperature, and the real important thing about this is that it shows that we recharge when it's cool, which is actually the best time we can possibly recharge. And we irrigate when it's hot, and that's good because it's more mobile when it's hot, but we never actually get leaching beyond the root zone when it's hot. So it maintains the carbamazepine, and we'll have to run this for more pharmaceuticals, but for the most part, it shows that by chance, our system is the best for protecting groundwater from contamination by pharmaceuticals. And that's.
Thank you.
We have time for one question. Gordon.
What was the carbamazepine?
I mean, what?
Oh, what do they use it for?
It's antibiotics?
No, it's used for epilepsy. Is its main use? Well, no. Epilepsy is its label use. Its main use is used off-label for control of bipolar disorder.
Okay. Thanks very much.